Okay, welcome everybody to this seminar. I call it a seminar now. I think we've got to start calling it a lecture. But anyway, wonderful to have you along here. This particular event, as you know, is organized by LSE Ideas, of which I am one of the two directors, the other one being Professor Christopher Coker from the International Relations Department, now full-time with us. As you know, what we try and do with LSE Ideas is many things. We are a research center within the school. We do many research projects. But the other thing we do, and I'm very pleased we do it, is we are part of a larger, wider international think tank circuit. And the person who has made, I think, this circuit work and who is as energetic as any human being I know is the gentleman sitting to my right here, Dr. James McGann from Penn. I said, "Where were you, Jim, recently?" He said, "Well, I was on a tube trying to get here." But he said, "Before that, I was in the Middle East." And I don't know where you were before that. So Jim travels the world promoting, working on think tanks. And in a sense, I think, has been at the very center of many of much of the work that has been done and which we are very happy to be associated. I won't go into all of Jim's many, many accomplishments. If you look on the website, you'll see his publications. You'll see what he's doing. Where are you off to next, Jim? Where is it? Except for going
Bangkok.
Back home.
Bangkok,
okay. Oh, that's not very far.
No, it's
no,
not.
You'll be okay.
24 hours.
24 hours. Oh, that's nothing for you. Anyway, I'm not going to bother to say much more other than to say I'm really pleased you could all be here. There will be a reception afterwards, after we finish. Fill in your forms at the very end, because we like to get feedback. That's always helpful for us to improve what we do. Finally, I'd like to thank all those who've made this meeting possible as well. The people who work extremely hard, and I can see them all around in this audience here. Thank you again for all the hard work you have done. So with no further ado, Jim, I'm just going to hand over to you, and I wonder if you could put your hands together and give Dr. McGann a very warm LSE welcome.
We need to remind people that this is recorded, so I'll be careful as to what I say, only in that I won't curse.
Ah, right. I swear.
There is the subject of today's discussion, which is basically digital and political disruptions, and I'll go through that. I know in terms of the audience is globally diverse, I have, as Nick has alluded to, traveled extensively. I've now been to 111 countries, some multiple times. So if you have and have studied, part of the work that I do is to research on the major trends facing think tanks and policymakers and the public around the world. I rank all of the think tanks in the world, and I'm either famous or infamous, depending on where an institution is. On there recently in Milan 2 weeks ago, as only a Russian could, came up to me and or I came up to introduce myself to him, and he said, "We are number 37 on your list." He didn't introduce himself.
Hello, 37.
Very clear about it, how he felt about that. I thought 37 wasn't bad, but he obviously, I think, in terms of his the way he framed it, was not entirely pleased. But, and then, as Nick has also alluded to, I have, in terms of identifying the top think tanks in the world, felt that it was not enough, given the challenges that we face in terms of the policy sphere, not enough to identify the top think tanks, but to begin to bring them together and to create a global community of think tanks, which has now been realized. There are six summits, of regionally based summits in every region of the world. And a global summit, which will take place, and that moves from one region to the other. This year it will be in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. And so I, for good or ill, travel internationally usually twice a month. And I teach, my paying job is teaching, and I teach on Mondays consciously because then I can, you know, travel the rest of the week. And I say all of that if you have specific questions, and you know, many of you are students, you know, so you want to work at a think tank. If you have questions about that, the reality is that the nature of think tanks, partly driven by the things that I will allude to, have changed. The business model for think tanks has changed. The political environment in which they operate has changed, and all of that has created very fundamental transformation in the think tank industry, which is a separate topic. But I can, you know, answer those questions, and in terms of the certain context of the think tanks in specific countries, I've done and traveled extensively to, and on an annual basis, in addition to the seven summits, organize in partnership. All of these are in partnerships with think tanks within regions and countries, but two important emerging regions in terms and countries in terms of think tanks are India and China. So I hold an all India and all China think tank summit now in each country over the last 4 years. So I've not only done research but also been in the on the ground in those countries. I first and foremost want to thank LSC and IDEAS for essentially hosting this, and I think I've never told you this, but I think it's a great name for a think tank. You know, in terms of
don't ask me where it came from. I've no idea.
But it's a strike of genius. Whoever
it was, me. It was
okay.
Me.
There we go. There we go.
Sorry, I didn't know you.
I wanted to private.
I didn't know you were going to use the word genius.
So, but you know, the part of what I think is the, and I actually just read the history. And there's, you know, one dimension or one characteristic that a scholar described think tanks. One is challenging conventional wisdom. And the reality is, and I'll come back to this later, is an important function, especially in a world, which I will describe shortly, is characterized by increased polarization accompanied by policy paralysis. And so let me, in terms of the context of the speech or talk or dialogue, because I want to get to the point where you ask questions, I want to do three things. I want to lay out what are the digital disruptions, what are the political disruptions that are taking place, and unfortunately, what are the underlying drivers that make it possible, which I'll come to, for politicians to exploit and manipulate the public for what has not changed much, one of the few things in terms of for political gain. And so let me go through that. And you know, I would say... to be, and I should warn you before I start this, my students call me Dr. Doom. First of all, I teach global issues, politics, and institutions, which, you know, if you're talking about global issues and or transnational threats, I always have to warn my students not to, you know, get overwhelmed by it, and don't certainly go back to your dorm room and... consume some mind-altering or state-altering substance and put the covers over your head. You know, the intent is really to have you have a greater understanding of the issues and to be motivated. The reason why I teach is to motivate students to do something about the problems. Mm-hmm. And I take them to Washington and New York to see that there are many dedicated people at the UN, at the World Bank, at the IMF, who are working on these problems and are passionate about it and dedicated to it, as opposed to just hearing about the theories and the issues. So the digital disruptions, and there are several, and these, I think, are not, they are enablers and facilitate and are transforming in a very fundamental way and in a warp speed, which is transforming politics and our lives, and will accelerate as we get more and more harness AI and 5G. Those things policymakers are not prepared for, the public is not prepared for. There's always the historical dimension of policy lags way behind technological or advances in technology and science. And we are seeing in the last several elections in the U.S. and in terms of Brexit, the implications and the coming together of sort of political, social, and technological things. So I'll deal with the technological part, some of which people have in various stages attributed the political disruption to, I think, erroneously, or focusing on one dimension of the problem, not on all of the facets, to fully understand it, and more importantly, to respond to it. So let me go through them. One, you know, things are some are fairly obvious. The internet, it does create and has created the potential for connections, both good and bad. It is also, the web has also created interdependence, information interdependence, and a dependence on each one of us. I would contend that, you know, you've all, the numbers on how many times you look at your text or emails per day is astounding when you come to realize it. It's absolutely created a tremendous information dependence, but has also linked the world together. The one that is, those are sort of have been here and have been going at a relatively slow pace. What is now accelerating and has a direct implication for politics is the ceaseless advance, technological advances. And the advances are creating and accelerating, which is the fourth point, creates what I call the increased velocity of information and policy flows, which we are seeing. The technology, AI, and 5G, et cetera, are accelerating the flow of information within our individual lives, but also around the globe. And that it is moving toward warp speed, and our ability to manage that, as in terms of think tanks and the public and certainly politicians, lags way behind. And that's what we're seeing now, and that it has profound disruptive and transformative dimensions. The other part, and the key part that this creates and connects to the political and social dimensions, is it creates incredible insecurity and instability. Because of the disruptions, and you can look in business examples, and the slow response. So I teach at the University of Pennsylvania, you know, went to the University of Pennsylvania, you know, 1,000 steps from my office, what used to be a long queue of cabs. They vanished in the last 3 or 4 years. Last year on the trip to the airport, when I finally hailed a cab, which is now impossible, if you are now required to call an Uber because there are no cabs to pick you up. So I asked the guy, I sort of said, well, you know, Uber must have destroyed your business. And he said, agreed. He said, but now we are able to do what Uber says. You can call us on demand. So I went back to my office. I said, well, when was Uber founded? I mean, when did it first come online? It was like 10 years. And so they're 6 years too late in responding. And that's the central point. is that the changes are moving faster than our ability to adapt. And that's the disruptive parts. And the shelf life. And when I talk to my students, I sort of, how many, not jobs are you going to have, how many careers? How many careers do you think you're going to have in your lifetime? We're having a bidding war here. Anyone? Just yell out how many you think.
Four.
Six. Five. Do I hear six?
Six.
Do I hear seven?
Seven.
Do I hear eight?
Nine.
Okay. Nine. It's nine. Nine careers, not jobs. And that is why institutions are focused on lifelong learning, and that you have to acquire a set of skills that are essentially going to prepare you, your life, unlike my life, certainly, the only constant in your life will be change. And it is highly disruptive. It creates insecurity. And that is part of the dynamic that is taking place. Despite if Donald Trump is vanquished through impeachment, which is unlikely, and he'll probably leave office before he is impeached. And those who think that, in terms of Brexit here or elsewhere, that polarization, fragmentation, political paralysis, manipulation, and will end, dream on. That the genie is out of the bottle, and that what will come next are people that are much more skilled than Boris, or much more than Donald Trump, but will use the tools that I laid out. Because what has happened is, in terms of the internet, in terms of understanding the dependence on social media, and the sort of advances in technology and AI which make it possible, and made it possible for Donald Trump to essentially identify, energize, and mobilize a group of people just enough to win. And this is what, in terms of the connections, that people have not fully made. The first wave of why Brexit, why Donald Trump, was it's a globalization backlash. Wrong. The next wave, which we're now in, is that it's polarization. Not totally wrong. But I would contend that, you know, that the polarization we face, which is next, is really connected to the next and really explains everything, is that we have atomized polarization and fragmentation. That, you know, traditionally polarization is left and right. But now we have such fragmentation within the political sphere, which is the real thing. That people talk about globalization, they talk about polarization, they don't talk about fragmentation. And this is connected to the technology. In terms of the fragmentation, I would contend, is atomized. Meaning, and if you look at German politics, if you look at Trump's strategy, you have now a fragmented, but not between left and right, but multiple parties, multiple groups, energized, mobilized, and influencing politics. And the one that will prevail, like Donald Trump and other smaller groups, will be the one that can mobilize and energize a base just enough to win, because the votes are so fragmented that that's all you need to win. And the political system, certainly in democratic countries, is not equipped to deal with that reality. And so that it is, and I think in part of what Donald Trump, and certainly was revolution for the hell of it. In the 1960s, there was a guy named Jerry Rubin who wrote a book and was, you know, radical, and essentially said revolution for the hell of it. The basic view is that the accommodation with progressives or Democrats has not worked. We've tried. And now what we need to do is totally dismantle the system. You can see that in the UK. You can see that in the US in terms of alliances, etc. And can be successful in that. The related part of this is customization. In terms of the fragmentation, you can now identify through AI, which is what Trump did, and connect people that have a highly specialized, customized political interest and unite them with others in order to win. And you can do that through technology. And that's where the technological advances and the political dimensions come together for very scary prospects. All of this is connect, these two are connected because the fragmentation, the polarization has created a crisis of confidence and immobilized political establishment, political parties and elite. And so you have an opening, a vacuum that allows these individuals who essentially suggest, and politicians suggest, that they have the solution to a problem, and they demonize and identify specific issues that help energize. People wonder, how can Donald Trump get away with all that he has gotten away with? You know, who hasn't he offended? But the astounding thing is that the 45% is really immobile in terms of their support for him. And those are the people, and that's what I'm talking about, mobilizing just enough to win. And if you look at, anyone watch the election, but it's here in Europe, if you look at Germany in terms of the Greens, Christian Democrats, Social Democrats, and the extreme right, fragmented enough to really, and those who are losing most are the establishment parties, the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats. And so it's the extremes that are doing that, and they may fragment more, which makes it possible for extreme parties and views to exist. And that's what Donald Trump has done. He doesn't really care about, I mean, the impeachment is a bonanza for him because the 45% to the U.S. And the reality is, even though people are support, 52% are supportive of the inquiry in terms of the impeachment, it's evenly divided for those who sort of say, do you favor impeachment? So there's very little movement there. Now, that all may change, and I think this may be the end moment for Donald Trump, and it's fundamentally different, but that's a whole separate thing. So the question is, what makes the public so susceptible to this? The technological dimensions. So, for instance, in the U.S. electorate, and in, when you connect the dots between the crisis of confidence, the policy paralysis, meaning that established parties, the elites, don't do anything about the problems that people face. And there's a crisis in confidence, and someone who says, I'm going to change things, I'm going to do things, and in many respects, Donald Trump, had he not made in terms of hubris, an error of judgment, and I always said he would be the one who would be his own undoing, is that he could, for his constituency, in mobilizing and winning, had a number of, you may not like his actions, but he has taken actions that he can point to an agenda and an action agenda that the Democrats don't have, on immigration, on tax reform, on getting tough on China, and several other areas. His problem is he shakes things up, but he doesn't have a strategy. But he has done things and would have, in terms of looking to the election, a specific set of accomplishments. You may find them important, but the reality is for his base, and that's where customization is, they would do that. And I think here it's the same thing in terms of knowing what you have to deliver on and stay focused on that and not have an accommodation. It's yet to be seen whether he will be able to deliver on a Brexit deal. But that's all the thing. So the question is, given the political dynamic of dysfunctionality and a world that is in transition and accelerated in terms of the transition and disruption of what you know, what you can rely on as a result of the technological advances, I think, which has not been explored, and will not, we will not see the end of or the decline in the sort of populist or the disruptions, political disruptions certainly, until politicians and political parties and elites understand the underlying problem. And the discussions in academic circles suggest that it's that the underlying problem is globalization, or now polarization. The question is, why are we polarized, and why is the electorate susceptible to polarization? Part is a crisis of confidence, and the crisis of confidence, I believe, has a number of sources, but the key part is that most of the electorate is adrift in a sea of insecurity. That it is a number of insecurities that politicians and our institutions have not effectively responded to, and that our think tanks have not effectively responded to. And that will continue. And so the take-home message is that polarization, fragmentation, manipulation, and increased insecurity and instability will grow. Whether Brexit is resolved, whether Donald Trump is out of office, that phenomenon is here to stay, and we, everyone in this room, who's in this school or not, in other institutions, needs to learn how to deal with that and to deal with and respond effectively to what I describe as a sea of insecurity. And let me go through what that is, or what are the elements of that. You may want to add others. Mm. One is economic. And Hillary Clinton's mistake was describing those who were supporting Donald Trump, and this is a cautionary note, as a basket of deplorables. You know, the 45 million people or whatever who voted for Donald Trump, all were not, even if you saw unemployed or underemployed white males, is what she was the basket of deplorables that she was suggesting, who have views that are you know, offensive to many. The reality was that it wasn't that. That it were, you know, in terms of, and Nick, I don't know if you were there in terms of in the global summit in Canada, in Montreal, in an audience like this, 8 months before the primary, I predicted that Donald Trump would win. I'm not prophetic. I just saw and listened to people and saw, you know, Donald Trump destroy 16 or 15 candidates who had tons of money. Senators, governors, significant ground gain. Why was that happening? No one, social scientists were not collecting the evidence and sort of saying something weird's going on here. We better pay attention. And it is these factors that are now being, people are coming in to fully understand. The whole audience recoiled when I said that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was like horror. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that I had heard from little pockets, like a friend who manages a medical practice. And so the best contrast of what one might think is a basket of deplorables, you may still think they're a basket of deplorables. They were doctors, 25 doctors in a practice. And our friend asked, how many of you are voting for Trump? 24 of the 25 admitted to her privately, which is part of the problem. Mm. Publicly, they wouldn't do that. Mm. And it's customized. Could be around healthcare, could be around taxes. It's the customization and connecting those at which technology and AI now makes possible, and what this guy from Idaho who worked for Trump, paid very little, was connecting. His whole job was connecting these little pockets, energizing them and mobilizing them. The other connected, and where you sort of see connections, as you hear things which stick in terms of trust in the U.S., most people, after the election, it was documented, essentially would only trust what those people in Facebook were within their circle of friends. And so the crisis of credibility and trust in government and leaders was zero. Who do you trust? Only the people in terms of what you take in, what you believe, even if it's, and this is where manipulation is powerful, if you manipulate those Facebook group of friends of 10 multiplied by the thousands, it's a powerful thing, and AI and technology makes it possible to influence those circles of friends, because the person who ran Trump's campaign experimented with different messages, with different colors to reach groups, and then was able to know definitively how that was done and able to mobilize them. That genie is out of the bottle. Fragmentation, polarization, manipulation is going to grow. And it is now a global phenomenon. And your job is to figure out how to get ahead of it and how to solve. And so the economic insecurity is not a basket of deplorables in terms of white unemployed males. It's you guys who are indebted in terms of, certainly in the U.S., in terms of college, and will never achieve, which I think is most of the advanced industrialized, you will never achieve the level of lifestyle that your parents have. That's a reality. Secondly, your parents realize that they cannot provide for you what their parents provided for them. And thirdly, that the elderly who are on a fixed income see that shrinking. That is the basket, and they are not deplorables, all of whom are in a basket of economic insecurity and connect. Now, they may not, in terms of the overall, feel the connection to Trump, but they certainly feel the pain, and that the disparity between rich and poor is growing, and that's clear and plays into this, especially in advanced industrialized economies where there is slow or no growth, and that slow and no growth will be sustained for a long period of time. So this is not going, the fundamentals, the underlying causes, which I think are really driving this, are not going to change, and we have to figure out how to manage that, and that's the challenge at the end. The second is physical. It's about terrorism, although that's faded. Who knows? It's only a matter of time. But the environment has really replaced terrorism as a fear factor that is really growing every day. And that the implications of climate change are real and omnipresent. My daughter, who's 13, is terrified. And I see the anxiety level in terms of students that I teach. And I'll come back to that, because it's not just a single element in terms of this sea of insecurity where people are adrift and desperate for a solution, desperate for a way out. And it is then not surprising why politicians prey on them in terms of simple solutions. Mostly in Europe, but in the U.S., is national and personal identity, and they're two separate things. What does it mean to be an American? It's certainly no longer Euro-white. That Hispanics and Asians will be equal to Euro-whites in numbers in the U.S. What does it mean to be in the U.K. or in Europe? And then the second part of that is personal identity. National identity is one thing which most people cling to. And if you look at Yugoslavia, when the political bottom and economic bottom fell out of Yugoslavia, what filled the vacuum was nationalist rivalries, and Sam Huntington, that was the source of his thing. But that's true. I mean, people then go looking for in the personal identity, which is the insecurity brought about ceaseless technological advances, and why you will have 9, maybe 10, maybe 12, who knows, it's going to accelerate. What is your, most of your, which many of you, given the surveying the age here, you know, employment and work is not a current center of your life. But for most people, your job is, gives you meaning in life. And so the personal identity is tied with your profession and job. Mm. Think about it, when that is constantly changing, and what is happening in the world is incredible insecurity because the job you may have may be totally replaced. I tell my students, when I ask the question about how many careers are you going to have, I sort of say, as an example, what was the lifespan of a phonographic record? 1920 to 1960. Replaced, you know, and the only innovation of a record during that entire time was it was a very brittle substance that if you dropped a record, it would shatter on the floor to vinyl, which was, you know, unless you really were crazy, did never, you could hardly destruct. You could heat it, and that would be the only thing that would. And you had went from, you know, six songs because it was only on one side to 12 songs. 1960 along comes the audio cassette. 12 songs, portability, you could take it with a cassette recorder to the beach, in your car, replaced in less than 10 years by a CD, which had 24, great portability. How many of you have iPhones? Tell the truth. Raise your hand.
Who doesn't have one? Yeah.
And so how many songs can you have on your iPhone? 1,500. Mm-hmm. How many people have records? How many people have cassette players? That's what you're going to face in the future.
Arnold.
That's a, you know, that's how that's what your career is going to be about, because there, those things are going to be, no one's in the business of selling cassette players or CDs. Portable PCs are gone. And the rate and the point of it is that the time in terms of creation of new products is shrinking, and just wait for AI. It's going to accelerate to warped speed. And your ability and success in life will be dependent on how much you are engaged in lifelong learning and how much you continue to be ahead of the curve. The third, or fourth, excuse me, is a new world disorder. We haven't really emphasized, in terms of cumulatively, the connections of these insecurities. Who's in charge? I mean, the world wasn't a great place under the bipolar world in terms of the U.S. and the USSR, but there was a greater sense of stability. And for those of you who are IR majors, you know, a unipolar world is the most stable. Bipolar is next. Multipolar, not so. And what we have now is a whole world in transition. And the rise and fall of powers are probably the most dangerous time. And also, for the average person, is who's in charge? I mean, you know, one day, you know, and Putin constantly, you know, everyone sort of, you know, Obama said that, you know, it is no longer a major power, but Putin seems to be making it work. In terms of inserting himself everywhere and effectively. I don't think, you know, Russia still has economy the size of Norway, I think it is. So it's not an economic
power. Size of Texas.
Texas. So, you know, that part of the, you know, what's going on in the world, and in a period of major transition, largely in terms of the rise of China or Asia powers, what does that mean? What's the world going to look like? Will it be rules-based? When the Chinese take over, what's the world going to be like? What does it mean for Europeans and North Americans? Major changes that create insecurity or connect it to job, identity, and in terms of just basics, you know, the traditional national security. The fifth is one that I sort of touched on, which is information insecurity. The reality is, whether it is cable news network or, more importantly, social media, because, you know, 6 years ago I asked my students, did you see such and such on, you know, 60 Minutes. And, you know, students told me, I don't have a television. Because you get information continuously, and on your laptop, you don't have a television. And so the continuous dimension of it is, and where you get your information is fundamentally different. And that everyone, many of you may or may not know that, you know, Henry Kissinger, in terms of public policy and as a policymaker, described being a policymaker like being at the end of a fire hose, meaning that 24 hours a day, water's coming at your face. It's not just policymakers anymore. It's all of us. We are all at the end of a fire hose, and it is that phenomenon that makes us all insecure. You can't get away from all of the sea of insecurity. It is surrounds you continuously and creates both anxiety and insecurity. Two more, and then I'll sort of wrap up. One, which is the problem in terms of the crisis of credibility. Who do you turn to solve, to deal with, to address the sea of insecurity? Our leaders. Mm. And what have they proven? They are proving to be bungling, corrupt, incompetent, and certainly not providing any answers and absolutely no action. I don't have to even say that here in the UK. We have our own problems, but, you know, the fact that Brexit is not resolved and that you're taking everyone to the edge of a cliff, and that it's unlikely, you know, we're going to have the answer today and then that all evaporated, and it just keeps going and going, and that instability, that indecisiveness creates anxiety and insecurity, and we are all in this sea of insecurity. And finally, in terms of the technological dimensions and these other factors, it creates a major feeling of instability and insecurity. Change brought on by advances in technology, and specifically AI, which will transform. And what people don't fully understand is AI is not like any of the other industrial revolutions. It is going to be so fast and so profound and so pervasive that everything you know will change and is going to move so fast that you may not be able to catch it and or understand it from a policy standpoint. That creates that change. And the change in terms of the rise of China or Asia, coupled with all with the sort of changes in the environment, change is difficult for any of us to accept and process. My point is, there is a sea of change that creates the sea of insecurity, and no one is trying to make sense of it. And only those who sort of say, I'm going to take control, I have the answers, and they do it by demonizing and mobilizing, often not around the issues where the answers are needed, but about vulnerable populations or easy targets. Why target immigrants? They don't vote. They don't have the ability to vote. So it's any politician knows that, and, you know, structures what they do around that. So what to do? This is, as you said, you probably now realize why I have my students call me Dr. Doom. But I think that the issue is, and what must be done, is to be aware of these things, to understand the interconnection, to understand that it's not just globalization, it's not just polarization, it's not just fragmentation. And it's not just technology, but it's also a whole set of economic, social factors, and the fact that our leaders have not addressed them, have not gotten ahead of them. Why? Because it's easier to, you know, criticize your opponents because you may feel, well, there's nothing we can do about it. Part of that is born of the reality that advanced industrialized economies, have slow or no growth, and therefore no money to do anything about anything. Or certainly not the money that they had previously to provide some solutions to problems. And you could add a crumbling infrastructure, which, you know, those things, there's a whole range of things that when you look around that need solutions. And so what can you, what should you do? Part of it is around awareness. The second is we're going to have to be much more innovative and much more creative, not only in thinking about problems, but more importantly, thinking about how to bridge the problems and to create consensus and a mandate for change for key things. And that is both around innovative ideas and process. And that's why I'm here. I mean, that's what this school is for. And it is, this mess is yours. You know, I tell my students I'm going to be in Florida. Not really, I would never do that. I'll be in Florida, you know, going for an early bird special in the movies. The other part is that I use the analogy of the pig and the python, is that the demographic bubble of which I was a part is like a pig. And when a pig swallows a python, you can watch it go through. And that's the demographic bubble. And the reality which you should be highly motivated for is we're going to consume everything and leave nothing for you. And so if there's any, you know, if there's anything that would should motivate you in terms of creativity and change and innovation, because the solutions are going to come from technology and from creative policy solutions, and you are the people that are going to be in the center of that. And it involves engagement. The traditional sense in terms of think tanks, which is what is the core message at all these summits, is that policymakers are no longer the sole consumers of what are produced by think tanks. And that the public, social media, play an important role in understanding and being ahead of the dynamic of those who are able to effectively manipulate with bad information or misinformation and essentially be savvy about how ideas are communicated and engage, and effective ways of engaging the public in a constructive way around these issues is also part of the solution. And then the final part is acting. The public, in terms of a sea of insecurity and the anger that is felt and the willing to follow really flaky leaders, is based on the fact that following what were established leaders for a long time who haven't done a single thing is over. So, you know, part of it, I think, is Jerry Rubin. You know, revolution for the hell of it. I'm going to follow this guy or this woman because they say they're going to do something. And what's the difference? You've made a mess. Maybe this person will take a risk. Mm-hmm. The problem is it's a high risk. And, you know, we see certainly here in the United States the implications of that high-risk strategy. And so action coupled with awareness, innovation, and engagement are the key to solutions, and that's where you guys are in the driver's seat. And then finally, I would just sort of say, which is, you know, part of what I, in terms of my political activism, was if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. And that's what should motivate you. So, okay.
Okay, thanks so much, Jim. Well, there was one piece of news there, I thought. You think Trump will leave office before impeachment?
Yeah,
that absolutely cheered me up a bit.
I mean, I can quickly say that because you know maybe people, you know, care. I can talk about. Never mind. In terms of that, it's fundamentally different than Watergate. One is that Nixon was not engaged in the act; he was engaged in the cover-up. Hmm. Trump is clearly engaged, was engaged, and is documented in the actual act that is outlined in the U.S. Constitution as a basis for impeachment in two areas.
Mm.
And he is unlike, which is the scary part, unlike Nixon, because Nixon had a respect for the Republican Party, and you may or may not believe this, but really understood the importance of the office of the president.
Mm.
And his personal, lifelong prestige was tied up with both of those.
Mm.
And therefore resigned to save his family, himself, and the office, most importantly, and his party, the damage that would be caused by going through impeachment.
Mm. Mm. Yeah.
In contrast, and this is the final, not so good news, of Donald Trump, who cares only about Donald Trump, has repeatedly demonstrated that he will take everyone down with him and will go down with the fight, and is also, and this is the final really terrifying, and you will really think that I'm Dr. Doom, is that he would engage in an act that would be because he has demonstrated his capacity for distraction.
Mm.
And the ultimate distraction is a wag the dog, if you don't know what that reference is in terms of a war. My hope is that he will see that the other positive formulation is that he's going to make a ton of money, that he gets immunity and leaves office, and that's the deal. But my analysis of the personal or the individual level of analysis, which once again is a reference to IR theory, is that my analysis of his of the individual level is that's not Donald Trump.
That's not Donald Trump.
But he is driven by money. And so if he thinks they can't come after me once I'm out of the office because I'm granted immunity, and being president and all the connections he's made, he's going to make a lot of money.
Yeah.
Then that's enough to motivate him. That's what I hope that people negotiate.
Well, let me just pick up on the more general point, then maybe a brief answer. How much of what you're saying is really about what's happening in, well, you mentioned two countries.
No, it's global.
But is it, though?
Absolutely.
The question of confidence, let me just pick you up on that. I mean, I go to China quite a lot. I kind of talk to a lot of people in China. I don't get the sense that they lack confidence at the moment. I kind of get a view that where they're sitting, they're kind of feeling they're on the up. And whatever problems they've got, they are not the kind of problems when they look at the West. In other words, I know you say it's global, but I wonder what's going on in the world, maybe a bifurcation between a crisis of Western liberalism, crisis within the West, which may not be so generalizable right across the board. And I just pick you up on that briefly, and then we go into a Q&A.
I can answer that.
Yeah.
Two ways. One is in China, and Hong Kong is an example of this, that you can't be Chinese and not be optimistic about the future based on what has happened.
Mm.
I think that is, there are clear dimensions of the happiness quotient because, my wife was one of the first Americans in China, and we have very close and continuous Chinese friends. That is on one level in terms of economic.
Yeah.
And in terms of a natural and understandable feeling of the rising and greatness of China.
Mm.
But there is clearly, in terms of, in a broader sense, there is not the happiness or the confidence in terms of the future of anyone, certainly those in China, and certainly those who are hedging their bets in terms of China because of the environmental, the issue in terms of the fact that most of the people who, in terms of the development, move to the coastal areas. All of the families and aging are in the interior, mass numbers, the ability to, and no social safety net. A whole health issues, a whole range of things that, I think, and I sort of say that the rise of China, the demise of the West and the rise of China both are overestimated.
Yeah, yeah.
And okay. I think in that respect, I think that Chinese have much to be proud of, much to essentially, you know, embrace as the greatness of it. But there are
sure.
clear, there's a veneer in that that is not totally
yeah.
optimistic.
Okay. That's great. Okay, well, thanks for that, Jim. We can have a long debate about that. Why don't we open it up? I'll take two or three. Young woman over here, gentleman there. John there. Yeah. I wonder if you could. We don't have a microphone just to prove the LSE's technological prowess. But I wonder if you could just stand up, say who you are, and then ask your question. Could you just make it single questions, please? Thanks.
Okay, sure.
Thanks.
I'm Soyeon. I'm an international development student. And my question for you is, so you talked about a rise of insecurity and people like going to social media, getting wrong information and being manipulated, and also this whole idea of economic crisis. But isn't that like the advent of our inability to reform our political institutions constantly? So for example, the reason why a lot of people voted for Brexit is because of like the financial crisis and that nothing has been changed afterwards, the people responsible were not persecuted. So don't you think that in a way blaming that people insecurity and anger and this need to like go for radical change is based on AI and technology rather than dealing with the fact that there's also a historical like narrative behind
yeah.
this.
Yeah. My argument is that it's both.
Let me just pick up. Yeah, please. If you could stand up, say who you are.
Hello, my name is Karim. I'm a political risk consultant. I was just wondering in relation to the topic if think tanks will be increasingly drawn towards this polarized environment. Because we can see an emergence of a dismissal of expertise and rational thought in the era of fake news, alternative facts, etc. Will think tanks will be tempted towards this appealing to this divisiveness in the political environment, social environment, and especially when we think of the fact that, as you said, Nixon resigned today, there are many more think tanks that are partisan, that have clear ideological underpinnings, and how would this play out in the future?
Not ideas, I would point out. Thanks. Yeah. Yeah. Say who you are. Stand up.
Hi, I'm Gidon. I work at LSE Ideas. It's the China Foresight Coordinator. And I had a question on the role of think tanks, particularly in addressing the insecurity caused by a multipolar world. So I think you've recently written a book on the rise of Asian think tanks. And there does seem to me, at least, to be an increased interest in collaboration between think tanks in Asia and the West, and I was wondering what you thought the role this collaboration could play in perhaps easing some of the tensions which are caused by a multipolar world.
So three broad questions there, Jim.
So I hope I was clear that I see the sea of insecurity that the drivers in terms of technology, etc., as means by which the sea of insecurity is magnified, and that those who are politicians who hope to exploit it use to exploit and magnify, whether on left or right. So you can look at Elizabeth Warren or, you know, Donald Trump. They're both sort of exploiting and focusing on the sea of insecurity and how they will address it. To diametrically opposed approaches, but they both are using social media to exploit that. All I'm saying is that the technological dimensions enable and enhance in a new and much more problematic way the political issues that have always been there. Politicians have always, you know, used economic issues or social issues to win elections and to exploit it. All I'm saying is that technology makes it easier to manipulate in a way that has never been the case, and we really have to be aware and guard against.
But just coming back, just to pick up, if you don't mind, how much would you put, and you kind of didn't dismiss globalization and the insecurities it creates.
No.
You know, Danny Roderick wrote about this, you know, 20 years ago, on the losers of globalization, not just the winners. But how much, I mean, there's quite a lot of work out there that's been done that since 2008, which comes back to your question, that this was a huge rupture in the world economy. It's not a 1930s, but it's led to austerity. It's reinforced austerity, it's created greater job insecurity, and it's also created a greater degree, a lack of confidence
in the very elites that you've mentioned. So I think that picks up on your point. I hope it does. Anyway, yeah.
I don't in any way discount. I just sort of say that the emphasis on globalization and then on polarization is magnified more than it should be relative to the, and that there are other fundamentals that are driving the economic transformation, you know, largely as a result of the rise of countries in the South in terms of lower wage costs, lower benefits, and those things that are creating a shift and a challenge to the advanced industrialized countries, and they're ill-equipped to deal with it because there's structural rigidity and no resources to do with anything. Yeah. That's the reality. And the point is that globalization in 2008, like what I call milestones, was a milestone that brought that into focus and the economic disparity. But there's much more.
Sure.
It's broader than that. And for those to sort of say globalization, I think is, you know, fooey. Yeah.
No, frankly. I agree. Gentleman here, answer his question that she posed.
You're in terms of
tanks and polarization.
Yeah, well. Hello. This is a robocall.
That's Donald.
Oh, no, actually, it's probably Donald. Not Donald. It's like 5'2". Anyone know what the... Probably someone I should have answered.
Anyway.
I get so many robocalls, and the most annoying thing is when you're abroad and you get them, and you're paying not only for the annoyance, but... at any rate, the answer to that question is yes. I mean, the work that I do is to sort of, you know, how do, the challenge... Those who are involved in populism, their job, and in terms of how I critique the Republicans, their job is easier. They have a clear base and can communicate a much clearer integrated message. When you look at the 15 Democrats, which were 23 or 22, you know, it's chaos. And, you know, and so that provides... makes it easier. And my point is, how do you respond? And others are manipulating that even further. How do you create a response that is well-reasoned, that adds light, not heat, to the policy discussions and provide solutions? And understandably, the job is easier for those who are on either poles. And those are increasing because both see the opportunity to exploit. And that's why I've always said that Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders are both populist. The only difference is that, you know, they were cut of the same cloth but a different tailor.
Do you think think tanks should remain, however, if they're going to be credible, which I think comes back to your question, should actually try and be neutral?
Yeah, no,
their credibility does depend on them not actually being partisan or beholden to a special interest or a corporation or to a government, for that matter. Yeah.
Well, I mean, in terms of in around the world, that the only true independence comes from, you know, that people sort of say that focus on financial. It, you know, independence has three dimensions: legal, financial, and intellectual or institutional, and there has to be in place.
Yeah.
Safeguards on all of those. I mean, some sort of in Europe, and I don't want to ignite a firestorm, is Europeans think that all U.S. think tanks are corrupt because they get private funding. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I hear repeatedly, which I think is totally bogus. Anyone who, I mean, in terms of what minister or person within a ministry. Or in terms of after election, that politics, you know, and objectivity goes out the window in that. And all I'm saying is there's, you know, the best way to be objective is to have a diversified base, because he who pays the piper calls the tune. And as a think tank, you got to make sure that, you know, someone's not calling tune. And that you have, and what we launched to deal with this is a QII project, quality, independence, and integrity. Every think tank should be focused on how do you maintain that.
Exactly.
That being said, I think most people appreciate a partisan think tank that is honest about their, and you know what it is.
Exactly.
And that's a differential from those who sort of are clearly partisan, and I can look at a think tank, look at their board, look at what they produce, and tell what, where they're tilting,
sure.
And then they sort of say, we're bipartisan, when 90% of what they're doing is partisan. Mm. Whereas, if you look at Heritage, and you look at Center for American Progress, both progressive, very conservative, they sort of say, that's what we are.
Mm.
And, you know,
sure.
And some, and people find that refreshing because they're not masquerading.
Yeah.
You know, it does create problems. But
yeah.
And in terms of the public thing, you know, a place like Heritage has 600,000 individual supporters.
That's good.
So when you're talking about public support, but it's an Achilles heel because they can only do what those 600,000,
sure.
So they don't have true independence.
Mm.
Anyway.
On the Asian think tank, lastly.
Yeah.
I've never come all around. New round.
So, I mean, I spend a lot of time in Asia and in China. So I go to, you know, China. I've been going to China since 1988 and know that the scene there very well. I think, you know, not to be harsh, I may be challenged on this, but you know, unlike other countries, even in Asia, Xi has identified his top 25 think tanks, in part in response to the ranking that I do. In fact, I know he does. They are all, none of them are independent. Additionally, and I, you know, meet with my, you know, colleagues in China, several things that, you know, I've said. One is that most Chinese think tanks only care about what Xi thinks about them. And so in terms of what I challenge in terms of what I call meaningful partnerships, which other Asian countries have engaged in and continuously engaged in. So the Japanese, the Koreans, Singaporeans have partnerships, the money, meaning a meaningful research partnership on key issues. No money leaves China, other than, which everyone knows, tons of Chinese scholars go out largely not to engage in, you know, and this is an overstatement, not to engage in meaningful partnerships, but to show Xi how many contacts they have abroad in terms of MOUs. That's a reality. Xi doesn't like that I say that. He's... you know, and I pointed out, I mean, he said, he has talked about think tanks, so in terms of importance, mentioned think tanks more than any other organization in China, being central to the modernization and reform of China. He also has said that in terms of soft power and also in terms of, you know, power generally, that China should have think tanks that rival Chatham House, IFRI, Brookings, Carnegie, etc. My view, I mean, I go every year in terms of where there's, you know, significant participation, and so there's not a single view in China in terms of what needs to be done on innovation in Chinese think tanks. I don't call for independence because I think that would be a waste of time. I mean, not because it shouldn't be achieved, but people will shut down. What needs to happen in China, if you want to have great think tanks, is that they have to adhere to basic social science research standards, which is replication, being able to ask critical questions, to have access to the data. And most of the research in China is, you know, there are those who are doing serious research, but a lot of it they don't have. It's not because they don't want it, but the think tanks don't have access to the data that they need.
Yeah.
And there's a political dimension. And so, you know, there is an incredible, most growth that exists in think tanks is happening in Asia. There is a gazillion think tanks now opening in China. Every other week there's one. Now, because Xi has placed an emphasis, everyone is a think tank. The most problematic in China is that every news outlet now has a think tank, which is not really a think tank. And so those are problematic. There are some other issues, but in terms of engagement, in terms of constructive engagement, both within China with certain institutions and throughout Asia, I think refreshing development and a movement, which is really part of it in terms of the Asian experience. You know, there's always in countries a question of trust with think tanks and fear, because the fear that they're going to criticize. In places like Singapore, which I think, as an example in Asia, punches way above its weight. And it is, and in terms of, as a country, made, you may not, in terms of Lee Kuan Yew, you may not agree with him, but he made incredible strategic investments, smart investments, in creating schools of international affairs, mm-hmm. the Lee Kuan School of Public Policy, mm-hmm. which has created and spun off a whole host of think tanks, which has served that country incredibly well, and they are independent. In you know, they're university affiliated, and many are now moving out. I've sort of said to China, you need to look at Singapore as a model, and other countries, mm. and in the Middle East. I cite that as mm. as an example. You've got to invest in both to do that. So I think that there's fantastic things about what's happening in Asia.
Okay, I've got lots of hands going up, but I'll the young man here in pink, and then in yellow, and then the person in front of you. You're just going to have to stand up because, as I say, we haven't got a mic. So let's just say who you are and then ask the question. Over to you.
Hi, I'm Tom Ascott. I'm the digital manager at RUSI.
RUSI. Yeah. Royal United Services Institute. Yeah, yeah.
I've written a lot on this subject before. I wanted just to address some of, like, the core principles. U.S. National Bureau of Economic Research found that those who use social media the least are the most affected by it. It's over 75-year-olds who are most polarized. The youth aren't that polarized, it looks like. Young people using Facebook, they don't use it as much as old people. They know it's not true, a lot of it. Yeah. You know, and this also ties into this idea that there's a dismissal of experts. Actually, Edelman's 2019 study found huge bounce in confidence in trust in experts. So I just wonder, you know, these core principles we're basing this on, this discussion, you know, people being radicalized, this is a problem for the future. How true is that? Mm. Is it possible, actually, that young people are totally desensitized, they don't believe what they're seeing online, and they're not actually being mobilized by fake news?
Great question. We'll come on to that. Yep, please, yeah. Hi.
My name is Kushi. I'm from India, studying philosophy and public policy. My question is, in the context of a country like India, which is bordering on becoming an autocratic government now, how do think tanks play a role when the literacy level is comparatively lower than countries in the West, and at the same time, the diversity from where all the think tanks are coming is so huge that the think tanks also might not agree with each other in their research? At the same time, when the media, which is the news channels, which are the biggest medium of peddling that research into the public, have been bought off by the government, what role would you suggest that think tanks play in such an environment to shift the narrative back towards democratic ideals?
Okay, thanks very much. And then just in front of you?
Margarita, LSEADS. I work on programs and research. And my question sort of links back to polarization. As you were saying, I can completely agree with you that insecurities tend to lead people towards polarization. But we also said that think tanks should fight insecurities. But if think tanks are supposed to remain neutral and independent, how can they really fight these insecurities that polarization seems to be actually answering to?
Okay, so good question from all good questions. Maybe we'll start with the RUSI one. Is it true? I mean, basically, what does the evidence demonstrate? I think that's what your point is, yeah.
Well, and I'll start with one thing. There hasn't been, you know, in terms of certainly in the U.S. and Europe, the reality is that young people don't vote, and older people vote, and as you age, you become more conservative. And, you know, I think that is a dynamic that I haven't mention, which also impacts this.
I feel more left-wing than ever, but you know, there we go.
And so, I mean, in truth, I think that it, you know, I've sort of said social media, but, you know, social media and elites in terms of television do follow it. and that influences the larger population. So, I mean, I don't disagree at all with what you said. I don't know. I do know that those, and Bannon is one of them, in terms of, and in fact, we have in many respects, which will really get me into trouble here, we have Europe and Britain to thank for Donald Trump. Because the whole social media and harnessing of social media in terms of for political ends started in Europe. And there's clear documentation in terms of populist movements and the use of social media in terms of their message. So there's sort of a disconnect there. So I'm not quite sure what studies you've cited, but I do know that there is that is the influence. And to back to Mika's question, it is global, because if you look at Brazil, you look at the Philippines, you look at Poland, you look at Hungary, and one of the things that I've done 12 years ago, did a study on the uncanny coincidence in terms of a convergence of legal and extra-legal means in a set of countries, Venezuela, Cuba, Russia, China, and Turkey, and Zimbabwe, that they were using very similar legal and extra-legal means to limit the number, role, and influence of think tanks and other NGOs. I'm now looking at the fact that that was largely, you know, contained within authoritarian regimes. It's now spread. And so it is global. It is spreading. And I think that there is an uncanny connection. And you can watch the travel of Bannon and others. You know, that they're engaging one another and sharing strategies. And so it is happening. And social media is at the core of that. So, I mean, I, you know, I don't want to totally challenge it, because I do think that you're right. But the differential is, I don't think that I, you know, it may that there is that it's the audience that they're going after is not this audience. They're going after influencing media and elites through social media, who certain, I mean, there is no politician. And my advice to think tanks are, you have to be faster, smarter, better, and more mobile. What politician reads a policy brief that is printed? It's on his or her mobile. And so social media and where they get information is, whether it's, you know, and you look at it principally in terms of, if you're going to rent a car, if you're going to hotel, or you're traveling, you're going to go to social media. And part of the information overload, and an example of that is, who do you trust? They all say they're going to get you the best price. Reality, I have yet to really get the best price from any of those things. It seems to me a big scam. But
take the question on India, and then the next question on
India. Okay. I think, I mean, I see very positive on the think tank side in India. I mean, because, I mean, one is that there's a, the unfortunate part, which is a legacy of the past and not of democracy, is that most of the large, stable places to work in think tanks in India have the worst productivity. I mean, you know, I, you know, have gone, you know, on tour of Indian think tanks, and people were, did this really incredible presentation of, you know, the, their output for the last 2 years, which I didn't want to say because I wanted to be polite, was the output of like 2 months of any other think tank. Meaning that it was so low, and they're, you know, thinking. And, but the differential is those people have a stable environment, they have a stable clientele, and to a certain degree, they have greater influence on policy. Most of the think tanks, which is what, you know, I tried to address, are Delhi-centric, which is another, and the, you know, the general criticism from think tanks themselves is, you know, we need to diversify that. It's happening in terms of places like Gateway House in Mumbai. You know, the other issue is, and the inverse relationship is, that all of the other think tanks that would be, you know, challenging, much more democratically oriented in terms of ideas, are smaller, struggle for support because there's no tax incentives in India and no corporate understanding that in Mumbai or in other regions that there's a close relationship between the research that think tanks do and policy reforms that are in the business and community interest, and they should support them. And part of the message is that is you need to, as a community, come together and make that. Now, there was a law which is in place to provide for the largest corporations social responsibility, of which they were considering funding think tanks. That did not happen. It would have been a great thing to seed and fund a range of diverse think tanks. And that's what I'm advocating in India. I think there's a much greater competitive advantage, which India has not thing, you know, in terms of the highly educated, the English language, the rule of law, all of those things are significant competitive advantage for the think tank community in India that and getting broader funding mm-hmm. that are key to the success and vibrance and the democratic values within India.
And the last question was, can think tanks which claim to be and want to be neutral, therefore be engaged in pushback? I think if that, say that question.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think that, I mean, as I sort of alluded to, I think that's a key role that they play.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. The answer is yes. Okay, I'm going to
crawled under your...
Eh? What's that? What's
it? Nothing.
Okay. I'm going to take three more quick... I'm going to take one here, the girl here. Gentleman here, a lady over there. So, one, two, three. And, yeah, please, if you could just stand up. Oh, quick one question. Okay.
I thought it was something else.
I was like, what do you think? I'm throwing things out.
Sorry.
Hi, I'm a student in international conflict studies, and I would argue that one of the most important factors in this kind of insecurity that you described is the lack of trust.
Trust?
Yes.
Sorry, yeah.
Trust, what is truth, like the post-fact, fake news, etc. And I would advance the thesis that it stems in great part from the missed promise of the modernization theory, which became true for the generation of our grandparents, but which are now, in the long term, not being, they're not holding up.
Yep.
So wouldn't the solution stem from an overarching theory and discourse that would challenge the modernization theory promises that turned out to be fake?
Well, I think on that end...
If you could, sorry, just got to jump in on that one, Jim.
I think...
Yeah, thanks.
I think modernization, globalization, and I would now contend the promise of AI were all oversold, and we paid the price for overselling in terms of that... The world's going to be richer, better, more prosperous, more inclusive in both.
Mm.
And the downside, which most think tanks and policymakers understate, because the fear that if they stated it honestly, the policy wouldn't go through.
Mm.
And I think globalization, most recently, is an example of that. But modernization, and I would contend, watch carefully AI.
Mm.
Because the same sort of forces are at work.
I just want to make a woman there. Yeah, please. Yeah, if you could just say who you are and then a gentleman here. Yeah, please.
Hi, so my name is Cara. I'm a student at ADS. So my question is, if we try to bring this conversation in the context of developing countries, especially in Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa, where in French-speaking countries, think tanks are like really ineffective.
In effect.
Would you say that we have the same issues because in those countries we will have like an access to internet which is less than 50%, a literacy rate of 50%, and most of the time authoritarian president. So would you say that we have the same issues? And do you think that that's the reason why they're...
Okay.
Do you want to ask that question directly, and then we'll take one last question at the end? Yeah, answer that one now.
I mean, I know a lot about African think tanks, so to be give you an answer that you don't really like, everything you said is true, and even worse, 30% of all existing African think tanks are likely to go out of business in the next 5 years. at a moment and in a continent in terms of size and issues requires thinking, but there is a convergence of factors in terms of the exit of Hewlett and Gates, which had provided $175 million to support think tanks in Southeast Asia, Africa, and Latin America, but principally in Africa, has now ended without any sustainability for the plan for the think tank.
Mm.
The Nordic countries, because of Syria, et cetera, shifted their funding from think tanks to humanitarian. And so you have and the World Bank ended its support for think tanks.
Mm.
So you have a convergence of a perfect storm, unplanned, that will create this exit.
Mm.
In a region where you have institutions that are already and historically underfunded, understaffed, with regular turnover. And so it is a great tragedy, which will only come into focus when we have, which is inevitable, a major, major crisis in Africa and no one to think and help the countries or the World Bank think about it. And so I can send you a paper we've done and convene the top think tanks to sort of say there's a sustainability crisis and that the funding community, the world community needs to redouble its effort.
This has had to be the last question before our reception. If you could say who you are, a quick question.
My name is Brahim and I work in policy at an international NGO. You've mentioned extensively the impact of social media.
Unnamed international NGO?
Oxfam International.
Sorry. Well, you didn't have to say that.
You've mentioned extensively the impact of social media and AI on the election of Donald Trump, on Brexit, on the recent, events that have happened in Britain and the US, and you've thanked Britain for Trump. But
Europe.
How much of it is actually?
I'm in Britain. I wouldn't blame solely Britain. I wouldn't take all of you.
I would. I think Brexit.
Well, it's great that you can do it. Then
ask
I don't have to take responsibility.
Stop interrupting, Paul. Yeah.
Thanks, Mick.
That's okay.
How much of it is just, in reality, good old-fashioned politics of people not wanting to vote for the, for example, hawkish foreign policy ideals of someone like Hillary Clinton, or the failures of the new Labour of Tony Blair, or the failed conservative policies of David Cameron and Theresa May. I come from a North African Muslim country, and I thank the Lord Almighty for Donald Trump's election, because if Hillary Clinton had been elected, for example, my people would have been annexed thanks to the involvement given by the Clinton Foundation to our next door neighbor, who would have completely annexed and committed a complete genocide like we're seeing in Turkey. But yeah, how much is just good old fashioned politics?
Well, the answer is, which I hope is clear. It's traditional politics on steroids, made possible by social media and AI. Machiavelli, it's like the reality is that politics is politics. What has changed is that it's now on steroids, and the steroids are social media and AI that make the manipulation, make the exploitation much greater and moving faster is the other part than we can. The political system, the one of the comparisons between Nixon and Trump is that Nixon was able to respond to the allegations and spread them over time because of the news cycle. Whereas now Trump is really going to be undone by his own instruments that he's used, because he can't keep up with the developments and respond effectively, and he doesn't have a structure, which is an interesting and ironic dimension. But it goes both ways.
I'm going to pull it to an end now, simply because of time, and I we